Hi, I'm Lawrence Akers and welcome to another Outthink. Today I'm thrilled to say that we're talking with Dr. Tracy O'Keefe. Now, Dr. O'Keefe is an internationally recognized and acclaimed clinical hypnotherapist, psychotherapist, counselor, trainer, naturopath, and director of the Australian Health and Education Centre. She is an expert in crisis and trauma recovery, alcohol and drug addiction, and has worked with over 20,000 patients face-to-face. She is herself a trauma survivor, having been abandoned as a child in institutions, and went on to become a highly successful therapist, writer, researcher, and public speaker. She has been the author and co-editor of several books, including Finding the Real Me, True Tales of Sex and Gender Diversity, Trans People in Love, and the Amazon bestseller, Inspiration for Survive and Prosper, Personal Transformation Out of Crisis, which I can wholeheartedly recommend myself. Our chat with Tracy today is fascinating, covering everything from the acronym Alphabet Soup through to the impact of same-sex marriage legislation and back via a discussion on addiction and the impact of vice on the gay community. For those who are keen to find out more about Tracy or to reach out to her, I'll provide full details on the Release Hypnosis website about her clinic in Sydney or in the links section below. I should point out that this interview was conducted over Skype, and unfortunately technology was not on my side for this interview. However, I was so impressed with what Dr. O'Keefe shared, I've kept the interview as is and worked with the audio as much as possible. With that in mind, let's jump straight into a conversation with our guest for this Outthink, Dr. Tracy O'Keefe. With the recent successful changes resulting in marriage equality, what kind of impact has that had on LGBT relationships that you've noticed? And has there been perhaps any negative sides to this along with the obvious positives?
I think I have to backpedal about three steps just to come back to the spaghetti labelling. Mm-hmm. We don't use the LGBT yada 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 forever letters because it leaves people out.
Yes.
So we talk about people who are sex, gender or sexuality diverse.
Yes.
And that's important in the way that people are free to identify in whatever way is acceptable to them. And also many people felt they were left out of the campaign for marriage equality when they got ballot papers that talked about gay marriage. And for many people who are sex, gender or sexuality diverse, they don't identify as gay, but they didn't have those rights. Well, the change in the law is wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful because it really means that now anyone can marry anyone above 16 years old, which is how it should have been anyway.
Yes, absolutely.
And that you don't have to rock up and say, I have to tick this box. Do I qualify? Of course, we have the famous Norrie case in Australia where Norrie, after 13 years of fighting, we got Norrie declared as sex non-specific. So it means people like Norrie who are sex non-specific and intersex people and people who don't really want to say whether they're gay or not gay or bi or not bi, which is very much part of the younger generation's attitude.
Absolutely.
Can now go along and say, well, there's two of us, we'd like to get married, and we're not really interested in ticking any of those boxes that pushes into a stereotypical, unrealistic description of what we might be. Now, many of us may identify as male and female, but not everyone does. No. And I think it is really taken a lot off the shoulders of many, many people. People who identify as gay, people who identify as bi, people who identify as transgender, transsexual, intersex, non-sex or gender specific, to enter into legal relationships that gives them legal protection, but also in society enables them to say, well, this is my partner.
Yes.
And I would like you to respect that. And the law says you have to respect it as well. which is a very good thing. So I think it's been a marvelous relief for so many people. And really, after the vote, lots of people have been celebrated by marrying their partner and acknowledging each other. But just making it matter of fact and every day. So many people have had a great sense of relief in bringing it, being married, into sort of ordinariness, and that they can just carry on their lives in a very peaceful and happy way.
Did you find during the same-sex postal survey debate that you had people coming in to see you with issues that they were surprised about, coming to the surface from that actual survey?
Well, as you say that, actually, yes, I did. Mm-hmm. You know, I see gay men and women in my practice, and trans people and sex and gender diverse people. And over the time when the survey was being put out to people, some people were very anxious.
They were indeed. Absolutely.
Because they'd invested a large part of their life in trying to fight for this. And the way in which the survey was sent out to the public didn't really respect sex, gender and sexuality diverse people, because it was like the vote of the guillotine, thumbs up or thumbs down, which doesn't comply to Australia's commitment to the International Human Rights Convention. So a lot of people went through a lot of stress during that survey. But I think now it's passed, they're getting over the trauma, and it's just becoming an orderliness. Although politically, for sex and gender diverse people and sexuality diverse, it must never be considered as ordinary, because we're a minority. And I think we always need to protect those rights.
Absolutely. And what advice would you have out there for listeners who perhaps are still feeling the aftershocks of that same-sex survey? I know personally a lot of people that I spoke to were actually quite surprised at what kind of feelings that survey stirred up, and felt that they had dealt with those issues long ago, and were actually quite shocked at their own feelings that were coming to the surface there. Given that we've had such a successful result, we'd hope that most people are now feeling comfortable with that and being able to enjoy life. But for those who still find that there is something lingering there, what advice would you offer to them?
I think it's important to focus on your victories in life.
Yes.
And your successes and achievements. And it has been a mammoth achievement. And every single person involved, every person that it affects, was part of that achievement. And even people who identified as heterosexual who were involved in it, they were part of that achievement. Mm. So I think it's important to own the success. And many things in life are very traumatic when you're trying to correct a wrong. And when that wrong is corrected, I think it's very important to move into celebratory mode. Mm. And relish your victory.
Changing topic into addiction. Within the gay community, there seems to be a rise of this chemsex or party and play, as it tends to be known. And obviously, while we're not here to judge the behaviour, it has resulted in many people forming an addiction to illicit substances, especially ice. What kind of impact have you noticed from the people you've worked with around this issue?
I love the Americanism, party and play.
Yes. It almost sounds like, you know, they're holding some sort of Tupperware party or something.
Exactly, yes. I think it's important to remember that chemsex has always existed. Mm. You know, if we go back to the Egyptians were doing cocaine and having sex. And if we go back to to ancient Rome, we can see the profuse use of alcohol and orgies. And throughout time, alcohol has been associated with sex, mm-hmm. Particularly in the 60s as well, the 1960s, when the beatnik and the baby boomer generation came through. They smoked dope and they took acid and, you know, free love. And then in the 70s, we had all sorts of influences coming out of the factory in New York with Andy Warhol, of people taking amphetamines and fixing up heroin and having sex. And the whole films were made about that.
Yeah.
In the 80s, of course, we had E's. And everybody was so lovey-dovey when taking E's that it broke down a lot of barriers between people. Methamphetamine is not new.
No, it's not. It's been around for some time now.
It's been used for a long time. Hitler himself took methamphetamine, and he gave it to the soldiers as they marched into countries to keep them awake.
Yes.
Methamphetamine gives a particularly big high, really big high. And also the other drugs that come under chemsex as well give a state of being that is really very different to our normal conscious state.
There's certainly a lack of inhibition that goes on there, which you know, can obviously drive people to engage in far riskier behaviour than what they would have normally.
It is, and it is very much about disengagements of parts of the brain that operate good risk assessment. And when you take influences that disable those parts of the brain, people do take riskier behaviours, particularly younger people between 16, 17 to about 25, because less myelin sheath has formed around the nerves in the brain. So they don't use the logic circuits that older people do. There's a lot of protectionism around culture and chemsex in the gay world.
Yeah.
For instance, around poppers in the 70s and 80s, around sex on poppers. And a lot of people who are having chemsex often think they're in control. But any mind-altering and substance takes away a certain amount of control from you. So the decisions that you make sometimes may not be rational. And they're not decisions you might make when you're in ordinary consciousness. So I think there's a lot of worry around chemsex, and particularly with the arrival of PrEP, because PrEP's sort of given a mentality that it's really okay to go back to the early 80s and have sex here, there, and everywhere, and whatever consequences you have can be cured or might not occur. But PrEP isn't 100% successful. No. And we don't know the long-term effects of PrEP as well. One of the major problems that comes with chemsex is it can lead to addiction. And I do see a lot of people who experience addiction from being involved in chemsex activities. Now, the knock-on for that is that it can really disable the body. The immune system can begin to collapse. The gastrointestinal system can begin to collapse. The adrenal system becomes unregulated. So people really move into illness with addiction. There's also the mental problem that occurs in that such substances do cause a level of brain damage.
Certainly they impact on the dopamine receptors there. I know that long-term use can cause serious damage to the amount of dopamine that's released into the system.
They do, absolutely. And they disable the ability to produce that dopamine and thereby serotonin as well. But also there's another effect that's called white spotting in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So white spotting is throughout the brain, and it's a series of thousands of mini strokes.
Wow.
And the problem is once they have those mini strokes, they're unlikely to repair. Now, it's been about 47 years that I've been working with people around stimulants. And over that period, I have seen people who have basically fried their brain and they really don't recover or do well.
Mm.
And what is a particular concern in joining PrEP and ChemSex together is that people are thinking that, okay, so I'm protected from HIV, but they're not focusing on being protected from the long-term effects from continually using those drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And the people I see coming into clinic are people that have extremely high anxiety. They have post-drug-induced psychosis, they have paranoia, they have depression, can go on to bipolar, they may have a psychotic break, go into beginnings of schizophrenia, but also there is the social impact, and the social impact is about they may be doing well, they may be making loads of money, but the ChemSex gets out of hand. And a year later, they're broke.
Yeah.
And that's the impact is not only physical, mental, but social.
Yes.
So putting aside the judgment around ChemSex, because humans will always perform ChemSex, I think it's important that we draw people's attentions to the risks that go with that, because there's a lot of PC mentality and propaganda that goes out, which talks about minimal harm. But in clinic, we see people who have experienced maximum harm. And for those people, any level of those drugs is catastrophic.
Mm.
And I think the information going out to people needs to be more clear and needs to be better quality information rather than just saying, here's a condom and make sure you take your PrEP and don't use too much ice.
I was going to ask, obviously, people are different, but what are some of the main causes that drive someone to develop habitual behaviour like ChemSex or addiction with ice?
I think we have to look at the access and connection between people's psychological makeup, their emotional makeup,
mm-hmm.
their social situation, their family background, their economic situation, all that may form a constellation to guide people to certain groups.
Yeah.
For instance, if you came from a family that was really difficult and you were emotionally starved and suddenly you found these group of people who were partying and playing and they wanted you to be part of your group, you sort of attach to them.
Mm.
And drugs are really cheap. And if you don't have wealth and if you don't have social status, which is gives you privilege, you might be attracted to that cheap relief from ordinary everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice to party with people and to have people think you're fantastic, even if it's only for a matter of 8 hours.
Mm.
So I think we have to think of everybody as an individual.
Absolutely.
And that people arrive at that place of chemsex addiction from many, many different directions. And we can't pinpoint and say they arrive there for this particular reason, because the next person, that might not be relevant to them.
If someone is working through their own cycle of addiction and recognizing that they need help to overcome that habit, what advice would you have for them?
I think get help is the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Because many people, when you're in addiction, you are in denial because you convince yourself you're in control.
Mm.
You absolutely convince yourself. And any challenge to the idea that you're in control, it is alien to you. But if you're an addict, you are not in control. And it is a delusion that you think you're in control. So the first part of recovery from any addiction is to recognize what denial is and to realize that you need help.
Mm.
Get professional help. That's really, really important, because they can see you from a third perspective, a third eye. They can suggest things and help you and guide you back to sobriety and back to a place where you can get your logic circuits back as well.
Yeah.
And they can support you. It's important to have that support, that somebody is there to help you and they're not personally involved with you.
Mm-hmm.
So they come with no agenda. It's simply a task that you set to do together. And a professional has a whole basket of skills and knowledge that they can use to make that journey easier and quicker and more effective for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you haven't got money to see a therapist, there are groups that help you. There's self-help groups. There's Narcotics Anonymous. There's Sex Addiction Anonymous. There's Alcoholics Anonymous. There's also government-funded groups. And there are charities that deal in addiction as well.
Yeah.
So if you reach out, there are people there who will help you. One of the things I love about working addiction is there's so many different organizations that will reach out and help people. And that's really useful. I mean, if you're of a particular religious bent, or if you're of a social persuasion, you have particular political views, you'll find a group out there which will help you. And if you feel that you don't fit into any of those, some of the great groups to hang out with is Straight Edge.
Yeah.
Because Straight Edge is a movement of people who don't take drugs, they don't drink, they don't have promiscuous sex. And you might think that, oh, that's really boring when you're in the middle of addiction.
Mm.
But if you are in the middle of addiction, you're in crisis. And maybe time out would be a good thing.
Yes, sometimes it helps to refocus the mind.
Yes.
And I was going to say, the other side of that tends to be the impact that this issue has on the loved ones of those people. You know, certainly family members and partners who see their loved ones struggling enormously and are unsure about how to best help them. In your experience, what can someone do to help someone who is struggling with this form of addiction?
Yes, that's a difficult one, because it depends whether it's a friend or a... Parents have the most difficult time
mm.
because they want to rush in and save their offspring, and they're so emotionally connected to the person
mm.
that they're unable to have an objective perspective. They're unable to see things clearly, and sometimes there is a danger that they may facilitate the addiction. For instance, I had one family come in, and rather than the offspring being involved in sex work to fund their addiction, the parents were buying the drugs for them. And the parents thought they were helping them, but they were actually facilitating them.
Yes.
And partners can be devastated. I think, again, with partners, getting professional help is very important. Somewhere you can go and talk about your situation, that you can gain clarity of mind, and that you can have support as well. And that's very important, because if you're with someone who has an addiction, it's a rough ride. And you must be strong yourself and not be dragged into the black hole of the chaos that surrounds addiction. And it's very important that you are supported to remain strong and to remain objective, because the addict is lost. And you, as the supporting member of the family or the supporting friend, cannot join them in that lost space. Otherwise, you can't actually help them.
Yeah.
So to help someone, you must be strong yourself, and you must step back and look at things from a distance so you can go in and help where you need to in a way that best serves the addict to recover.
I'm almost having in my mind that airplane metaphor that we often hear about, you know, when the plane's going down, you need to make sure that you have your life mask on first so that you can help other people around you, or capable of helping other people around you.
Absolutely, but yes.
I guess it's a wonderful metaphor when it comes to mental health and addiction, to make sure that you're strong and resilient and capable of dealing with these situations so that you can assist your friend or your family member or your loved one.
Yes, and it's a mystery to me why government does not offer support for families and people who are dealing with someone with addiction. I really don't understand that, because it doesn't work when you don't give people support. One of the best examples of a change in social attitude is Portugal. In 2001, Portugal decriminalized drug possession and took all the money it took from prosecuting people struggling with drugs into helping them rehabilitate, apprenticeships, helping them get on their feet. And now Portugal has one of the lowest drug problems in the world. So we can see that supporting people having a problem and their families actually works. And it's really important that organizations also campaign to governments that they offer support to extended families as well.
I think one of the reoccurring themes that has come up through our conversation today, and something that I know that is very much an area you specialise in, is that concept of resilience, or that ability to find resilience. I know in the first chapter of your book, Inspiration for Survive and Prosper, Personal Transformation in a Crisis, you were incredibly transparent and open about the incredible challenges you face at the start of your life. And, you know, resilience is really the word that comes up out of that. I know it's a very broad question, but I guess for someone who is struggling to bounce back and who perhaps is feeling stuck or beaten, what advice would you have for them to find their inner resilience?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, my life was very rocky to begin with. Both my parents had mental illness. I was a trans child in 1966, which was completely unheard of. And the abuse and social ostracization one got as a young trans person in those days was relentless. But I think I always believed in the goodness of people. And I've met some wonderful people throughout my life who have helped me in so many ways with acts of kindness, with asking nothing in return. And what that did in me is install optimism. So we all, as human beings, go through our darkest nights. It doesn't matter who we are, what our background we're from, how wealthy we are, how many letters we've got after our name, none of those things. We all go through crisis in our lives. And when you're in a crisis, it's important to survive that crisis and use the right skills to survive the crisis. But you cannot live the rest of your life in crisis, because that's not a life.
No, it's not at all.
That's a trauma.
To be constantly experiencing each day as if you're under attack or fear of attack is just a horrible experience.
Yes, it's re-traumatizing yourself. And so I talk in the book about also going through the second stage of transforming. Mm. And there are many transformations in life. Marriage, of course, is a perfect one.
Yes, exactly.
Puberty, menopause, andropause. And transformations are a natural process. So we must eventually leave the survival stage of post-trauma, go through transformation, and go on to lead a life of prosper. Mm. Because we are so lucky to be alive and to see the sunrise and to have food and a roof and people who will say hello to us, that no matter who we are and where we are, there's another day. One of my favorite people that I follow on the internet is a yoga teacher who's 99 years old in New York. She's going to be 100 soon.
Wow.
And every morning she teaches yoga. And she teaches yoga because she still enjoys it and because she goes Latin dancing in the afternoon.
What a phenomenal person.
And the dresses are expensive. And it allows her to dance with the young men as well. And what she says is, every day I get up, I say to myself, this is going to be the best day of my life. Mm. And throughout a day, you know, there's problems throughout all of a day for all of us. But I think resetting ourselves constantly to move towards prosper in our life enables us to embrace and enjoy a good life and enjoy the blessing of being alive, because it is a blessing. It's a wonderful thing. Mm. And, you know, the smell of the roses, strawberry ice cream, and people. I've always had a love of people.
Yes.
People just, spending time with people is like food.
It's that connection that you can build with people and to be able to feel accepted and part of something.
It is. If you're isolated, you're starving yourself.
Yes.
So always making new friends, always seeking new contacts, new people, and keeping the, which is Facebook is fantastic. Mm. Keeping the people who have supported you the whole of your life. I've got friends on Facebook from when I was 14, 13 years old, who maybe I haven't seen for 30 years, but I still chip in on their posts. And I think hope and optimism is a very good thing for you to have in your darkest hour.
Yes.
And don't expect it to change all by itself.
No.
Because it's your life, and it's for you to operate it and steer it in the direction you say you would like it to go.
Mm-hmm. I know that I often ask people during session, you know, a question like, if today was your last day, how would you like to be remembered? For, you know, what kind of behaviors and traits, and you know, how would you want people to go, I thought of this person as being like this, and how does it differ from how your day may even plan out, not having that drive or that thought?
Yes, it's the many questions that therapists can ask can provoke so many new ideas in people.
Mm.
and shifts in consciousness as well. And that's a wonderful thing. And I do tell people when they're in therapy with me, we're not here just to chat. Mm. We're here to roll our sleeves up and to do the work we need for you to get to the goals that you need to go to.
Yeah.
You set the goals. We devise the strategies to get you there.
Mm.
And it's eminently possible that people can change their life in so many different ways and have a fantastic life.
Mm.
Because life is for the enjoying.
Exactly. We only get one chance at it, so we may as well be in the moment and enjoy it as fully as we can.
Yes, indeed.
I did have one last question here, but in many ways I think your wonderful answer that you've just given has summed up many of the answers to this. I'll ask anyway, it was a broad question, but what are some of the core values and beliefs that you have that allow you to get through your day, continue and be such an incredible source of inspiration and a power for good?
Well, I was up at 5:30 this morning because I needed to be on the microscope at 7. So the chappie that came to see me had been going around to all sorts of different clinicians and got all sorts of conflicting advice.
Mm.
And really, the blood told the story. We spent a wonderful 2 hours together guiding in the direction he needed to go. And it was just nice to be able to help someone, because for all of us, altruism is the key to self-healing.
Mm-hmm.
In that life isn't just about us. Life is about the ripple effect and the way we affect other people's lives.
Mm.
I think my inspiration is I like to get up in the morning and try and be someone who I would have liked when I needed help when I was young.
It's a wonderful thought.
Yes. I had a teacher when I was very, very young. There was only 3 books in my house as a child.
Mm.
The Bible. Apparently my father was a Catholic. I never knew that. My mother's cowboy novel, which he read about 500 times.
Mm.
And the story of Robin Hood, which is really a book of thieves and not suitable for children.
Mm.
But when I was 9, I had a form teacher who read me Wind in the Willows, which is a English children's story about a rat and a mole and a badger that live by the river that have adventures. And then she read us a story about Wurzel Gummidge,
mm-hmm.
which is a scarecrow that lives in a field, and they have a turnip head for maths, and they have another head for dancing and a head for something else. And I thought, well, I wonder if I could have different heads. And one day when my father had been taken away in the ambulance in a straitjacket once again,
mm-hmm.
I was in tears in the playground. The teacher took me into the library. I was only 9, and she took me into the library and she said, "Do you remember the stories I told you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, when you look around the library, all of the solutions you need in life, somebody will have devised a large part of it beforehand, and all you need to do is search for it." And she didn't know what she did to me, because she died a year later, but she infused in me a lifelong obsession with reading, which completely changed my life from poverty with no expectations to an attitude of, okay, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the voice that goes through my head all the time. What's next?
I certainly got that in reading your book, that there is a curiosity and a tenacity there to constantly learn more, to identify what it was that was missing in your knowledge and to fill that gap straight away.
Yes.
Dr. Tracy O'Keefe, I have to thank you so much for your time today and for your insight and wisdom. Certainly anyone listening who is keen to explore more of Dr. Akee's work, I'll place links for her books and website below. But I thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you and your listeners. It's been wonderful. And remember, go out in life and have fun.
I shall aim to do that every day. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.